Chapter 2. How a Person Sees and Feels About Other People. Those in law enforcement know that victims of violent crimes, such as abduction or assault, rarely use the word we. Instead, they'll relate the events in a way that separates them from the aggressor, referring to the attacker as he or she, and themselves as I. Rather than say, for example, we got into the car, they are inclined to phrase it as, he put me in the car. And rather than say, we stopped for gas, they might word it as, he stopped for gas. Recounting a story that is peppered with we, us, and our may indicate psychological closeness, certainly not expected in a crime, and implies an association, a relationship, and perhaps even cooperation. We can observe benign applications of this in everyday life. At the end of a date, Jack and Jill walk out of a restaurant and Jill inquires, "Where did we park the car?" An innocent question, but using we instead of you indicates that she has begun to identify with Jack and sees them as a couple. Asking, "Where is your car parked?" hardly implies disinterest, if, in fact, it is Jack's car. But turning your into our does expose a subtext of interest. Whenever I speak to couples, I'm always on the lookout when the word we is conspicuously absent from any conversation. Research finds that married couples who use cooperative language, for example, we, our, and us, more often than individualized language, for example, I, me, and you, have lower divorce rates and report greater marital satisfaction. Studies also demonstrate a powerful correlation between such pronoun use and how couples respond to disagreements and crises, predicting whether they will team up and cooperate or become polarized and divided. The use of you words, for example, you, your, and yourself, may suggest unexpressed frustration or outright aggression. In conversation, a person who says, "You need to figure this out," conveys enmity and a me versus you mindset. However, we need to figure this out indicates us versus the problem, a presumption of shared responsibility and cooperation. Can you guess whose marriage is in more dire straits? Person A. Our marriage is in trouble. Person B. The marriage is in trouble. Person B doesn't simply distance himself from his spouse, but detaches altogether from the marriage. It exists as some entity outside of himself. Other examples abound. Speaking about my children versus our children when in the presence of one's spouse, or about shared spaces as my house or my bedroom, informs us of the person's perspective. Likewise, an agitated parent may well ask her spouse, "Do you know what your son did in class?" in reference to something undesirable, while a positive situation may sound more like, "Do you know what my, or our, son did in class?" Again, a single casual reference does not mean anything, and any of these statements might signal someone's anger or frustration in the moment, not about the marriage itself. But a consistent pattern of syntax reveals everything. The implications and applications of syntax extend to the corporate arena as well. Research finds that firms where workers typically refer to their workplace as the company or that company rather than my company or our company, and to coworkers mostly as they rather than my coworkers, are likely to have low morale and a high rate of turnover. Same goes in sports, where a fair-weather fan can be spotted through his language. When the fan's team wins, they characteristically declare, "We won!" But when the team loses, it becomes, "They lost," because again, the pronoun we is typically reserved for positive associations and affiliations. The King and I. When a person offers up information, its sequence is significant. If someone brings up people, objects, or even emotions in what seems to be a random order that is not integral or logical to the flow of a conversation, we would do well to pay attention to that order. It typically broadcasts the person's subconscious priorities or indicates that he or she would rather not discuss certain things. You can remember this ancient but revealing insight into human nature courtesy of a biblical story. Two women came before the wisest of men, King Solomon. They had each given birth to a baby boy a few days apart. While sleeping, one of the women accidentally rolled onto her baby, suffocating him. She then switched her baby with the living one, but when the mother of that child woke up, she realized it wasn't her son and knew the babies had been switched. Solomon already knew through prophecy who the living child's mother was, but he wanted to demonstrate his thinking with irrefutable logic. He exclaimed, "This one says, 'My son is the live one, and the dead one is your son.' And this one says, 'Not so, your son is the dead one, and my son is the live one.'" Then Solomon asked for his sword and explained he would resolve the situation by dividing the living baby in half. One woman screamed, "No!" This, of course, indicated she was the mother of the living child. The legendary lie detection expert, Evan Noam Sapir, aptly points out that the second woman told the king, "Her son is dead, mine is alive." But the first mentioned her own child first. "My son is alive, hers is dead." Because her focus was on her own child, who was alive, and she accordingly prioritized him in her exclamation. Sapir cites another example from a Dear Abby letter. A woman wrote that her son had some sort of a problem, but her husband was not understanding. She wanted to know what she could do to make her husband understand, but in the letter, the woman mentioned herself, her son, and her son's dog before she mentioned her husband, and she gave the names of her son and the dog, but didn't name her husband. She rates the dog ahead of her husband, showing that her real problem is with her husband, not the husband's relationship with the son. This general rule of noting the order of details applies across a wide spectrum of situations and scenarios. For instance, when you ask a child about the members of her family, she may respond, "My mother, my father," and then rattle off the names of a few siblings. Certainly, we shouldn't assume something is wrong if she says "daddy" before "mommy," lists the siblings in birth order, or mentions her two sisters and then her annoying baby brother. Moreover, if Spotty the dog and Goldie the goldfish are mentioned before mom or dad, there's no reason for concern, particularly when it comes to small children. However, if a family member is absent or at the end of the list, after stuffed animals, pets, and the like, then further inquiry may be warranted. To be clear, the order or absence of a family member does not indicate that something nefarious is afoot, but it does tell us that their relationship is different from what we may have assumed. Similarly, when you ask an employee about her work environment, she might talk about "my supervisor" and then bring up some of her colleagues. We shouldn't assume that anything is amiss if she merely puts one associate before another, lists colleagues in hierarchical order, or first mentions her sister-in-law, the receptionist. However, if she starts talking about the coffee machine in the break room before colleagues or friends, this might suggest feelings of social isolation, aloofness, or lack of affinity for others in the workplace, and be worthy of deeper investigation. I recently met a childhood friend whom I had not seen in about 30 years. After the obligatory exchange of lies, "Wow, you look great. You haven't changed a bit." It was picture time. He proceeded to show me a number of photos of him and his dog eating lunch in the park, snuggling in bed, and catching a frisbee at the beach. Then he caught me up on the celebrities he was tight with, his finger swiping through selfies with his B-list chums. Dozens of photos, and an eternity later, he stopped on a photo of a teenage boy. dumbbells in hand, shirtless and solo. "That's my son, Mark," he said, plainly. A single swipe revealed the next photo. "That's my daughter." He gave no name. "She's at UCLA." End of commentary. Neither of his children's photos featured Dad. My old friend was still married to wife number two, but there was no mention of her. No photo of her. Nothing about her. Does it mean he doesn't love his wife and children? No. Maybe he desperately wants to connect with his family, but any number of personal issues or unknown circumstances might make it difficult. In that case, their relationship is strained, and his affection goes to his dog. Or perhaps he is egotistical, entirely self-consumed, and has zero interest in his family. He builds up a faltering self-image by showing off his celebrity acquaintances. We don't know for sure, based on this brief exchange, but we do know with certainty that his relationship with his wife and children is not rosy, and this is something that he never intended to disclose to me. All of the previous holds true in impromptu conversations and situations where forethought is not assumed. In guarded instances, such as a negotiation or mediation, a seasoned professional is unlikely to initially express his real interest to avoid losing leverage. The very fact, then, that a person completely ignores something that would presumably attract his attention, the 500-pound gorilla, tells us that this may be something that does interest him. Many years ago, I invited an art dealer to my home to look at five paintings that were left to me after my great aunt had died. I hadn't done my due diligence, as this guy was a friend of a friend of a friend. After glancing at the collection for a few silent minutes, he made a call and then said something to the effect of, "There's really not much here. Maybe this one," pointing to one picture, "is worth a few $100. But I can put them all in the clearance section of my gallery and get a few $1,000. How about I give you $3,000 for everything?" Now, I don't know much about art. Okay, nothing. But I do know about human nature, and I noticed that he had completely ignored one small painting. I found this curious because he gave all of the other ones at least a 2-second glance, even those that he subsequently declared worthless. I declined his offer and thanked him for his time. His offer went up. I declined. It went up again. After a few more rounds and several final offers, it became abundantly clear that he could not be trusted. He left, none too pleased, and I phoned an art appraiser, not a dealer, but one who charges a fee for his services. It turned out that while four of the five paintings, including the one that the art dealer said was worth something, weren't worth the canvas they were painted on, the one small painting he had ignored was worth approximately 7 times his final offer. Symbolic representation. A new mother is folding her infant's laundry. As she picks each tiny, lovingly purchased item out of the basket and smooths it out, she smiles. She stacks the fresh laundry neatly and places it in the drawer of the baby's bureau. With a small sigh of satisfaction, she admires her handiwork and shuts the drawer. Through her blissful execution of this otherwise tedious chore, the mother reveals the contents of her heart. She treasures her baby. We know this is so because she handles the baby's belongings with such love and care. Similarly, a person may cherish an item that belonged to beloved parents or grandparents. The item itself might be better suited for the recycling bin, but this person treats it like a precious heirloom. The concept of symbolic representation, illustrated by these scenarios, states that we can discern how someone feels about another person by observing how they treat objects associated with that person. In math, this is the transitive property. If A equals B and B equals C, then A equals C. Of course, in psychology, unlike mathematics, this is not a hard and fast rule, but it is another window through which we can gain understanding of others' behaviors. Symbolic representation can reveal important insights that may be difficult to glean in a more straightforward way. For example, a patient who had abruptly divorced her second husband after a 3-month marriage was concerned about her young daughter's adjustment to her stepfather's absence. I suggested that she give her daughter a teddy bear and tell her that it was from her stepfather. If the child hugged the teddy bear and held it close, the mother could assume that she missed her stepfather. If, on the other hand, she seemed disinterested in it, she could infer that the child felt little, if any, emotional attachment to him. If she was distraught and angry with him, she may exhibit destructive behavior toward the bear and throw it aside callously or try to pull its little glued-on eyes off its furry head. Once again, I didn't suggest we should draw a conclusive interpretation, but the way she treated the representative of her stepfather, Teddy Bear, would point us in the right direction. We all navigate the emotional space between ourselves and others through a variety of linguistic mechanisms. Simply by listening for slight shifts in language, we can gauge whether someone wants to be closer or is looking to create distance between us or themselves and another. This is useful when we want to figure out the level of rapport in any relationship, old or new. In the next chapter, we'll build on our skill set with methods that quickly determine who is enthusiastic and who is apathetic in any conversation and context.